Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lillian Nakagawa, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today's program, The World Shifts East, What It Means for the United States, by William H. Overholt, director, RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy and author of a new book called Asia, America, and the Transformation of Geopolitics. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Our thanks to the Asia Society of Northern California and the Berkeley China Initiative for their support of today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Professor Robert A. Scalapino, Professor Emeritus, Department of Political Science, University of California, Berkeley, who will introduce this evening's speaker, William Overholt. Professor Scalapino, who I am sure is well known to this audience, has been called the Dean of Asian Studies in the United States. He is the author of hundreds of articles and scores of books on Asia, has educated generations of students on Asia, and has served as advisors to heads of state and key policymakers around the world. We are honored to have him this evening to introduce our speaker and to serve as the moderator of our Q&A session. Professor Scalapino?
It's my great privilege to introduce Bill Overholt. Bill and I have been friends for many, many years. I think our first meeting was in 1890. It may have been 1892. Bill was very young. Since that time, he has had a most successful career. As has been mentioned, he is now director of RAND's Center for Asia-Pacific Policy and also Asia Policy Research Chair. But he spent a number of years, over two decades at the end of the last century, in Asia, throughout the region, but 16 years in Hong Kong itself. He has visited every region and, as has been pointed out, has written six books, the most recent of which, Asia, America, and the Transformation of Geopolitics, has just come out. I urge you to read it. It's a fascinating study, very broad in its generalizations, in-depth regarding the key areas, including the United States. And in this period when Asia is so important to the future of America and the world, this kind of research and work is extremely valuable. So without any further ado, I will ask Bill to take the podium.
Well, thanks, Lillian, and thanks, Bob. It's an honor to be at the same table with Bob Scalapino, and it's an honor to be back at the Commonwealth Club. This is my second time here. The first time was when I wrote my last book called The Rise of China. I had been writing for that time for many years saying that China was going to be a big success and that Gorbachev was going to destroy the Soviet Union. The reviews all said that I was not only an idiot, but immoral. I had an upsetting experience in Washington last week when I was doing a briefing on this book. I was going to places like the Pentagon, and the response was not the one I hoped for, which is, you're an idiot and you're immoral, because I learned that was what sold my previous book. Instead, it was, gee, it's a good thing that you're creating a new debate about strategic perspective. It was very reassuring to find that the government is filled with people who are willing to at least consider some new ideas. You don't hear a lot of that on TV. But let me shock you with my latest outrageous thoughts. I want to start by arguing that there are some very peculiar things going on in our relationship with Asia. First one is what I call the presidential cycle. Each new president comes in with part of the core, the moral core of the foreign policy, some dramatic policy that's hostile to China. So Ronald Reagan campaigned bitterly criticizing his predecessor Jimmy Carter for being soft on China and promised to upgrade relations with Taiwan. His successor didn't do this. Bush 41 was the only one who actually knew something about foreign policy and knew something about China. But the next one did. Bill Clinton came in bitterly criticizing his predecessor, Bush 41, for being soft on China, and promised to take away China's trading privileges, as at that time called most favored nation status, which would have thrown us back to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1920s, which we associate with the Great Depression. Bush 43 then campaigned bitterly denouncing Clinton for being soft on China, and said that it was outrageous that Clinton had called China a strategic partner, and promised to treat, in the campaign, to treat China as a strategic adversary or strategic competitor. After 18 months, each president actually in office reverses position about 178 degrees. So Reagan ended up promising China that he would never, that the United States would never increase the dollar value or the technological sophistication of weapons that we sold to Taiwan. That was a promise Jimmy Carter would never have made. Clinton ended up vigorously advocating trade and investment with China and calling China a strategic partner. Bush 43 has become closer to President Hu of China on the subject of Taiwan than any two Chinese and American predecessors have ever been. And when he and Jiang Zemin had a summit in Crawford, Texas, Bush 43 referred to China as a strategic ally in the war on terror. So something funny is going on here. The second, I would call the Armitage Report cycle. Many of you may remember that in the year 2000, there was a bipartisan report by Richard Armitage as a Republican and Joseph Nye of Harvard as a Democrat, saying that, you know, we're taking China too seriously. This group was outraged that Clinton had gone to China and come back without stopping in Japan to explain himself. Of course, Clinton had gone to China twice to Japan twice and strengthen a military alliance. And the trip to China was purely symbolic. But these people said it's just not right to deal with China without stopping in Japan. They said, we have to downgrade the priority of relations with China. Japan has to be the sun and the moon of our Asia policy. And so when Armitage came into office, they tried to implement this policy, and they got rid of all the China experts who had jobs like Asia Director of the National Security Council and Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, and replaced them all with Japan specialists. Where are we today? Well, the Asia Director of the National Security Council is Dennis Wilder, the government's leading China specialist. Chris Hill, the Assistant Secretary of State, has spent his entire time in office working with China to come up with the least bad policy toward North Korea and over the opposition of Japan. And when you look at the way this administration, and it's really not a partisan issue at all, deals with problems in Asia. On North Korea, we sit down with the Chinese, come up with a policy, try to drag everybody else along. War on terror, our intelligence guys and the Chinese intelligence guys get together, try to identify the bad guys. Regional drugs, regional crime, we sit down with the Chinese and try to come up with a way of dealing with the problem and try to drag the others along. This is even more vividly true in the economic area. Our big issues in economics in Asia, freedom of trade, freedom of investment, agriculture. Well, freedom of trade, the Chinese economy is about three times as open as the Japanese economy. If Japan is an island economy, so the share of trade in its economy should be much larger than a continental economy like China. But if you take total trade, exports plus imports, as a share of the economy, China's about 70%, Japan's about 24%. Same kind of numbers for direct investment. Japan just doesn't like us taking over significant Japanese companies or building very many big foreign companies. So even though the Japanese economy is four times as big as the Chinese and is in a period of reconstruction where it should be the greatest magnet for foreign investment in world history, China gets about $70 billion a year, and Japan gets about half of that. How about agriculture? Well, the really big issue for American farmers is genetically modified crops. The United States is number one in the world in innovation, production, and consumption of genetically modified crops. China is number two in the world in all of those categories. And we and the Chinese have an effective alliance on this issue against the Europeans, the Indians, and the Japanese, who just want to keep the stuff out. So the world is not working the way it's supposed to work, according to our bipartisan consensus of defense experts. There are a couple of other weird things. One is that we have built what is, by almost any standard, the greatest military machine in world history. And it costs about as much as all other significant militaries in the world combined. But for the first time in our history, we find ourselves at risk in two different wars. We're at risk of losing. Why is that? Well, you've heard the adage about generals always preparing for the last war. It's not just generals, it's all of us. The first study I did for the Pentagon in 1972 was a study of what the Nixon Doctrine would mean for the Pentagon. And we did a study of life cycle of foreign policy doctrines. They all went the same way. Your country has a big problem. Come up with a capsulized strategy for dealing with that problem. If it seems to work, it persists. And when the problem goes away, you find that the attitudes, the interest groups, the institutions that were formed to deal with that problem live on after their rationale has disappeared. So the problem, well, my favorite example of that is Washington's farewell address. He told the new nation as he was retiring, no entangling alliances. It was good advice. So we were a young, poor, fragile country. We shouldn't get involved in the nasty European wars. But that advice continued right down to 1913. It cost us a lot of lives that we were still still had a policy that was more appropriate for the late 18th century. And then after World War I was over, we went right back to no entangling alliances. And it cost us even more lives in World War II because we weren't ready. Well, why did we build the kind of military we did? We built the greatest military on earth for fighting the old Soviet Union. Why did we build the same things that would have been useful for fighting the Soviet Union? Well, the excuse is the China threat. The China threat is peculiar. It's all centered on Taiwan. And the politics around Taiwan are going very well. President Hu and President Bush have a pretty clear understanding on this subject. And inside Taiwan, whoever is the next president of Taiwan is going to be much more comfortable for both Washington and Beijing than the last president. But the military race is in kind of a death spiral. That's not the way it's supposed to work. The military, Clausewitz said, war is a continuation of politics by other means. Something all out of sync. Well, where does this come from? Some of the problems have to do with old Cold War images that just aren't valid anymore. Some of it has to do with new policies that have come in the wake of the Cold War. Let me talk about two of the former. The images people in Washington hold of China and Japan. If you read the scholarly literature about China's international behavior or what the colonels in the war colleges write, I say, well, China must be one of two things. It's run by commies, so it must be like the old Soviet Union. It must be wanting to take over the world and must be wanting to change other people's politics into something like their politics. This is the neocon view of China. And this is why you get a strategic literature that says, my God, Chinese are going to Africa. My God, they're buying stuff in Latin America. How awful. It's because that image is that it must be a threat to us like the Soviet Union. Problem is, China doesn't accept foreign bases as a matter of principle. And It isn't trying to change anybody's politics. We try to persuade it to change the politics of people in Africa, for instance. But they said, no, we've learned that lesson. We're not going to do that anymore. The second image, also dredged up from the past, is, well, they're a rising power. So they must be like Japan and Germany in the 30s and some other rising powers. And what we know about them is they cause a lot of disruption and violent disruption. So we better get ready for that. The one literature you don't get is what most East Asians see as the lessons of modern history, the lessons, the geopolitical lessons of the Asian economic miracle. What are the lessons of history if you're sitting in Asia? Well, Japan became a very big power without a military. The next rising power in Asia was South Korea. In the 1950s, their president, Syngman Rhee, who was running the most threatened country in the world, did the obvious thing. He put all of his money into the military. And they fell farther and farther and farther behind North Korea. When I was in school, everybody knew, it's just axiomatic, that North Korea was more stable and stronger than South Korea and always would be. Then a general named Park Chung-hee took over in 1961. And he followed a different strategy. He slashed the military budget. He said, we're going to bet everything on development, on economic development. And today, the South Korean economy is a minimum of 22 times the size of the North Korean economy. It's very clear who won. North Korea can still be a pain in the tail, but that's all. The rising powers in Southeast Asia were Indonesia and Thailand. And again, you go back to the 50s and 60s, and every country in Southeast Asia was trying to be a rising power in the old way. The old way is Thailand grabs a piece of Burma, taxes their peasants, sells off their golden temples, and then gets ready to grab a piece of somebody else. That's the way it was done for thousands of years. So Thailand had claims on Burma, and Thailand had claims on Malaysia, and Malaysia had claims on the Philippines and on Indonesia. Everybody claimed something Singapore wanted. Indonesia claimed the whole business, basically all of Southeast Asia. What happened to those claims? There wasn't a big war that settled them. There wasn't a big negotiation. Instead, there was a historical change. People figured out, by watching their neighbors to the north, that you could grow 7 to 10% a year if you focused your efforts on economic development and did certain things. All you had to do was copy the guys up north. And the British Empire was built on the Industrial Revolution, which is a way of growing 2% a year. Now you could grow 7 to 10, but one of the things was you had to have that mentality of Park Chung-hee. If you wasted all your resources on geopolitical ambitions, you couldn't grow 7 to 10% a year. So those claims mostly just evaporated. The land ones, nobody's ever figured out how to deal with the sea ones yet. So Indonesia and Thailand became the rising powers, not by becoming disruptive and violent, but by focusing on getting rich. Now, Deng Xiaoping came to power in China, and he looked around. He said, why is everybody else doing better than we are doing? Well, Mao was doing it the old way. Deng Xiaoping said, we're going to copy what our neighbors are doing. In my previous book, after people got over telling me I was stupid and immoral, they said, how'd you know that? And I said, well, I spent so much time studying Taiwan and South Korea that I could just see that what Deng Xiaoping was doing was emulating what they did in economics and in politics. And that was chapter 1 and 2. There was also a chapter 5 or 6 that talked about international behavior, and this book is a big version of chapter 6, which said he also emulated the focus on economics at the expense of geopolitics. So what did they do? Slashed the military budget from 16% of GDP to 3%. This is not what you read in the out in the newspapers. Long story about the buildup that resulted from fear about Taiwan going independent starting in the mid-90s. But slashed the military budget. China had had 14 major boundary disputes with its neighbors. It has settled 12 of those to the satisfaction of the other party. The remaining two are with India and with a border of Bhutan that's controlled by India. India has never settled a border dispute. The last one to be settled was with Russia, 1.5 million square kilometers. Empty Siberia, multiple the size of Western Europe, population less than that of the city of Hong Kong. And basically, given what's happening in the two countries, China could wait around and then inhale and get it, but no. Not worth it. Not worth the trouble. Then they went on a friendship campaign. They made friends with most of their neighbors. Probably the most successful campaign to develop friendly diplomatic relations that any country has ever experienced. Taiwan's a big exception. With Japan, you have to sort of check whether it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. But with the rest, they've pretty much developed friendly relations. All so they can focus on economic development. And you know what? If you're growing 10% a year and you just increase your military budget in proportion with your economy, you also get powerful pretty fast, too. The priorities are clear. So this is not the China of our Cold War fantasies. How about Japan? The Armitage Report said Japan should be our Britain in Asia. The view is that Japan has peace and obedience to us in its DNA. And since it's going to be our little Britain in Asia, it would be more helpful if it had some bite. Helpful if they'd build up their military a bit. And so, particularly because Taiwan is such a difficult problem. If you're a Chinese general coping with the fact that 2 or 3 American carrier groups could show up is a terrible, terrible problem. And you're always trying to figure out, if you're an American admiral, trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that this place is only 90 miles off the coast of China. And every year, China is richer and has more missiles, new destroyers, better airplanes. It's an impossible problem. So we're, like the Chinese, we are very obsessed with this problem. So we need Japan to help us out. But this image of Japan as our little Britain in Asia also may be a bit dated. People like Mr. Abe, the last prime minister of Japan, and Mr. Aso, who's still the most likely next prime minister of Japan, have a theory about building up Japan's self-esteem after long periods of great difficulty. And they point to the Yushukan Museum and the Yasukuni Shrine, a better way of looking at history from a point of view of Japanese self-esteem. Now, what does the Yushukan Museum say? It says, well, the U.S. deliberately provoked World War II. The colonization of Korea was at the request of the Korean people to save them from China. The advance into China, it's not called an invasion, it's an advance, was to save Japan and the world from Chinese terrorists. The success of Gandhi in India was a result of the virtuous Japanese army kicking the nasty Americans and Europeans out of Asia. And there are frequent references in speeches to the lost half century under the American thumb. Now, this is not unique. This view of not being America's Little Britain in Asia is not unique to the far right. When I was in Hong Kong through 1989, Japanese crisis started in 1990, you're just absolutely flooded with literature saying the 21st century is the Asian century and Japan will lead Asia and the incompetent Americans don't know how to run an economy and they're destined to sink into the sea, basically. Just flooded with this stuff day after day after day. So I don't know who's going to run Japan in the future. Mr. Fukuda, the current prime minister, is a marvelous, balanced, sophisticated fellow. His international politics is impeccable. But he's seen as the wave of the past in Japan. And Mr. Aso is seen as kind of Tom DeLay's politics with a little bit of Obama's youth and energy. He's new, and they definitely need something new. And there isn't much else new around. The opposition under Mr. Ozawa is an even more obsolete form of the old LDP based in the old agricultural lobby. So the world isn't working quite the way it was supposed to. What do the smaller countries think about this? Do they see China as the problem and Japan as the solution? Well, no. The previous president of Korea, who just left office, formally requested that our alliance, the Korean-American alliance, designate a potential enemy of the alliance. The enemy he wanted to designate was Japan. The prime minister of Singapore recently had a summit meeting with President Bush. He harped on one major theme. You Americans have got to come to a more balanced relationship with China and Japan. The Australians have been saying the same thing. Now, these are our most loyal allies, along with Japan and Britain, in the world. They're all saying the same thing, except Taiwan is an exception. Why do they feel that way? Well, they're not saying we want to be under the Chinese thumb. They don't want to be under anybody's thumb. They want balance. But they went through 30 years of having a lot of trouble from China, 1950 to 1980. And they went through 100 years of trouble with Japan. The first half of the century, it was keep trying to get out from under the Japanese military thumb. The second half of the century was increasingly under the Japanese economic thumb. Something like the steel industry in Thailand was just controlled by the Japanese. When China came along, there's competition. And it became a four-way competition because Chinese openness to foreign direct investment brought the Europeans and us Americans back into the game in a big way in Asia. So you got four-way competition. And as China rises, the pattern was very different. Under Japan, your steel industry in Thailand was the technology was Japanese, the management was Japanese, the financing was Japanese, the marketing was Japanese. Under China, sometimes the Singaporeans ran the show, sometimes the Americans, sometimes the Taiwanese. 84.3% of all China's technology-related exports owned by foreign companies. So it wasn't A controlling B. It was this complicated competitive market, and the smaller countries thought that was just wonderful. And almost nobody in Washington understands that. They want us there, the smaller countries. They want us with our military right there in case something goes wrong with China or in case something goes wrong with Japan. And we missed the second part. So, what are the new things in the equation? Where is this all heading? Well, let me end with five scenarios. The one thing I think I can assure you is that the future 10 or 15 years from now is not going to look like the present. There are just too many tensions between reality and policy. One scenario is that we may end up with a new Cold War. If we and the Chinese become obsessed with this Taiwan problem, and our generals and their generals have to be obsessed with it to do their jobs, they have to spend every night thinking what sneaky kinds of things the other side may do. Then we're in a spiral. Then China does become the new Soviet Union. Alternatively, as I mentioned, things are going pretty well politically over Taiwan. There is a chance of a deal. We could potentially do what the Chinese have wanted to do for a long time, just get this thing put in the refrigerator for the next 40 years. And the Taiwan people would have their democracy and their freedom and their prosperity. And we would have an economic game in Asia, not a military game. And if you make progress on the Taiwan issue, then all of a sudden it becomes possible to solve the Korea problem. China would willingly accept a unified Korea under South Korean management, unless it means American troops moving north to the Yalu or American troops there freed to focus completely on a Taiwan scenario. That's unacceptable. But suppose it takes a really confident American president to push for these. It could have. Suppose that happens when a prime minister like Mr. Abe or Mr. Aso is in charge in Japan. These people are refighting World War II the way some of our people would like to refight the Cold War. Taiwan and Korea, they kind of feel a sense of ownership about. An independent Taiwan and a divided Korea are vital Japanese interests in their view. In that situation, we'd get kicked out. We'd find what some of our diplomats are saying today. You know, it's so much easier to work with the Chinese. All of a sudden, we'd have one of these historical reversals of alliance. Sounds like science fiction, but it's happened before. Third scenario, the American people get tired of all this complexity. They get tired of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they say what they said after the Vietnam War. We're not going to pay for it anymore. And we get pulled back. Now, that's a problem because Sino-Japanese rivalry has gotten restarted. And the only thing that keeps that from getting out of control is us. So that's not a very good scenario for Asia. Fourth scenario, and there are only five. We're at a unique moment in globalization. All this ability to grow 7 to 10% and all the focus on making money rather than warring on the neighbor, that comes from globalization. And the world is kind of in a negative mood about globalization. The Europeans don't have a constitution because the French and the Dutch were afraid of the Polish plumber. The Doha round is in trouble. Japan just elected an upper house, which is essentially under the control of the old agricultural lobby. China is in a mood that I call reform fatigue. They lost 25 million manufacturing jobs and 50 million state enterprise jobs in the reforms getting ready for the WTO. And that's just been a little too much. So the current guys aren't big on moving forward with that kind of social stress. And here, our politicians are telling us that we've lost 3 million jobs to Chinese competition. China graduates 10 times as many engineers. All manufacturing is moving to China. American manufacturing is hollowing out. And their huge foreign exchange reserves mean they can blackmail us and take over the world. I've got a list of about 18 of those things that every single politician I know of in Washington believes. And the interesting thing is that every one of those things is absolutely false. They're all absolutely false. We can discuss those in questions if you want. So this globalization thing could turn sour very quickly. And if so, we know what would happen in Asia. We know from the 1930s Latin America. Because in the 1920s, everybody knew that Argentina was going to be the richest economy in the world and that Uruguay and other neighbors were going to be right there with it. Because these were the most open economies and therefore they were the most successful. But when globalization reversed, they were hit the hardest. And their economies and their international politics have never recovered. That brings me to the only scenario that I want my grandchildren to live under. And that's that we come to a more balanced relationship with China and Japan. With an absolute focus not on getting Japanese to help us with Taiwan, but on making sure Sino-Japanese rivalry never gets out of control again. This was our policy for 50 years after World War II, and we lost it starting in 2001. And second, we either find a new way to explain globalization or a new way to do it that seems fair to American workers. And we move forward with all these huge benefits that this globalization has had for the human race. I wish I could stand here and predict that that's going to happen. I have to say that our candidates, all of them, are much more in the mode of their predecessors than they are in the mode of solving those problems. But the negative attitude toward trade and China and globalization in general is much higher and deeper and wider than it ever has been for two generations. So I'm a little bit scared. Let me stop there.
Our thanks to Bill for his comments today. Professor Scalapino will be moderating today's audience question period. Just a reminder to our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The World Shift East's What It Means for the United States with William H. Overholt, Director, RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy, and author of Asia, America, and the Transformation of Geopolitics. So, Professor Scalapino.
Thank you. We have a number of questions here. Let me start with two that are related. The first is, to what extent could China's claim to regions like Tibet and Xinjiang be considered as China's holding on to the old way of territorial geopolitics? And the second is, why is there no friendship campaign with Taiwan autonomy and its traditional culture? Is that culture really a threat?
Important questions. On Xinjiang and Tibet, certainly the people of both the Uyghurs of Xinjiang and the Tibetans would like independence or autonomy, and China has sat on those. Since the beginning of this government, they've been part of China. Their prospects for being viable independent economies and states are rather poor. So the only solution that is likely to work is some form of much greater respect for local culture and some greater degree of autonomy. Turning Tibet into a kind of Buddhist Disneyland is not acceptable to the Tibetan people and not really acceptable to the world. On the other hand, even the Dalai Lama has backed off from independence. So the future of these places is as a part of China, but with some form of greater respect. And China needs to move pretty quickly and decisively. With Taiwan, there are different stories. And both stories have a certain historical validity. The Chinese will tell you that since the beginnings of the Qing Dynasty, Taiwan has been a part of China. That history goes back about twice as far as the history of the United States. The Taiwan independence people will say, well, that was all nominal and loose, and actually China has never really ruled Taiwan. Taiwan is so much a part of the Chinese sense of identity today that the rulers know that if they allow Taiwan to become completely independent, they will be overthrown. And at the same time, Taiwan, people in Taiwan are going to be very protective of their democracy, their freedom, their prosperity. The nice thing about this situation is that there is an overlap of interests. What 89% roughly of the Taiwan people care about is keeping the freedom, the democracy, the prosperity. There are about 5% who'd go for early independence, and about 5% who'd go for early unification, and 14%, you know, up and down, that would like early independence. A deal where there's some kind of nominal Chinese sovereignty, with Taiwan doing its own thing, having its own government, having its own laws, even having its own military, is broadly acceptable both to China, the people of Taiwan, and the United States. So I think we're going to continue with that kind of confused situation. There is zero interest in China in dragging Taiwan down to China's level. Under Mao, we wanted to drag down Taiwan to China's level. From the time of Deng Xiaoping onwards, the theory has been we're going to spend until mid-21st century building China up economically, socially, and politically to where the people of Taiwan would feel comfortable being associated with, unified in some formal sense, with the mainland. We're fortunate that the overwhelming bulk of the Taiwanese people are not Serbians or Bosnians or Kosovars who just have this sense we'll die for our own country. So we've got a situation here that's workable, and with a little increasing wisdom in both Washington and Beijing, and it's happening in Taiwan, we can formalize this deal to the point where everybody's reasonably happy with it.
This question. Do you know who is advising McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Obama on Asian foreign policy? And do you have any sense how their policies would differ?
There are a lot of people advising, and it's hard to sort out from where I sit in Santa Monica exactly who has how much influence. As an Asia specialist, I find it hard to identify any candidate who is dealing with the economic and political realities of Asia. We have a combination of economic populism that's driven not by advice from experts who know what they're doing, but by what will get the support of this union in Michigan or that furniture manufacturer in North Carolina. And there's a lot of chest thumping about, you know, we've got to be stronger. It's the same thing on the broad military issues. If you ask 100 of our country's real military experts who are not currently in an administration that they have to defend, they'll say the problem with our military is that we haven't made choices. We haven't decided which kind of a military we need, and we're building both a Cold War military and a military that can deal with the kinds of threats in Afghanistan that we really face. So the military budget's too big. We'd have a lot more success if we make choices. I'm very much in favor, by the way, of our having the strongest military in the world. I think that's essential. What we have to hope is that the 18-month cycle works. And I actually have a lot more hope that it's going to work on the military side than I do on the economic side, where I think all candidates are being pushed around by interest groups. And I find it very hard to sort out who understands the situation but has to pretend they don't, and who doesn't actually understand the situation. So I'm completely confused politically.
Do you think that Japan should and will play a larger international role, and will it secure a seat on the UN Security Council?
I think Japan could and should play a larger role, but it depends on what kind of a role. If Japan's foreign policy is basically to keep their role in Asian leadership by keeping Japan, by keeping China down, which is the unspoken essence of a lot of thinking in Japan, then a lot of the moves to become more assertive and build more of a military are going to be bad for Japan and bad for the world. If it means leadership and international peacekeeping, if it means leadership in solving the territorial waters and seabed issues that bedevil every pair of countries in Asia the way the land boundaries did, if it were to come to mean we Japanese are the first mature society, all societies are going to be gray one of these days, and they're the first ones to face the declining population and problems of a gray society, and we're going to show the world how to do it. Then I think Japan will become one of the leaders of the world. That's not happening today. Are they going to get a seat in the United Nations? At this point, no. They don't have strong American support. It takes Chinese, yes or abstention to get in. As long as they're pushing the rewriting of history in an anti-Chinese fashion, there's going to be no seat on the Security Council. And you can say that's terrible, that's unfair, but that's the reality.
We have two somewhat related questions on China. The first, please explain why all assumptions about China's role in the global economy are false. I do a lot of work in these areas, and I don't understand how China and India will not pull economic power from the United States. And the other is, how do you assess the impact of environmental outcomes resulting from the economic modernization in China upon its long-range future?
Okay. Since I can't run through all of the 18 false assumptions, let me just pick a couple. We've lost 2.5-3 million jobs to Chinese competition. And the assumption is that the manufacturing jobs kind of leave here and go there. And all the decline of manufacturing jobs is attributed to China. What's actually caused the decline of manufacturing jobs? Well, it used to take 40 hours of labor to build a car in this country. Now it takes 15 hours. That cuts the amount of workers you need to build a car by almost two-thirds, unless you're building three times as many cars, which we aren't. It's productivity increases that have led to the decline of manufacturing jobs in this country. About 2.5 million, and the Chinese decline of manufacturing jobs is for exactly the same reason, only 10 times greater. The reason it's 10 times greater, aside from the fact that they have more people than we do, is that they were so inefficient to begin with that as their productivity goes up, they lose a heck of a lot more manufacturing jobs than we do. The good thing about China is that they haven't blamed it all on us. They could have, because when General Motors goes in and links up with a Chinese company and starts making everything more efficient, there are, in fact, a lot of jobs lost. How about there are 10 times as many Chinese engineers being graduated? Well, it's apples and oranges. About 90% of the engineering graduates they have are not qualified for any job with a multinational corporation. With little training, they could fix my BMW. There are associate degrees. This is a country with five times as many, so they're graduating about the same number of engineers as we are, if you compare apples and apples. But this is a country with five times the people we have, and it's a country in a phase of development that's very engineering intensive. I could go on and on. But this is the kind of myths our politicians and most of our media believe in. Is it sucking away power from us? Well, you know, our manufacturing output is growing the same rate it always has. We just do it with fewer people. A richer economy is a more service-oriented economy, and more of those people have jobs, and by the way, higher-paying jobs on average than they would in manufacturing. There is a shift going on in the world with a couple billion people growing 7 to 10% a year when we're growing 2.5. Our total share of the world economy goes down, but we're not getting any poorer. And by and large, we're going from strength to strength. Our weakness comes from the fact that we spend so much more than we earn. And as we spend, it's like with a family, the money piles up in other places. But, you know, when Europe recovered from World War II and became rich, that helped us. It's better to have a rich neighbor than a poor neighbor. And when Japan became rich again, that helped us. We became richer. And the best thing that could happen in this world for us is if the Indians and the Chinese and the Africans end up having incomes that are roughly comparable, you know, within an order of magnitude. The environment. The way you get these countries to clean up the environment is to help them to get rich, not to hold them back. When I first went to Japan in 1963, the Japanese, the stuff in the air in Tokyo was so thick that you had to part it. And the Japanese couldn't make toys that would last 2 days after Christmas. And their export to this country was the Datsun. It was called a Datsun and not a Nissan because they were so ashamed of it. They started exporting in 1960 or 61 to Los Angeles. And the guy who was in charge kept writing back to Tokyo saying, you know, these things don't have enough power to get going on the California freeways. And it's really not a very good thing to, in a desert climate, to have all the heat of the engine coming directly into the passenger compartment. And the image I remember in environmental terms from Japan in those days was kids that had what was called Minamata disease. They were all tiny and twisted because of mercury in the environment. And you know what? Because they were economically successful, they were able to clean it up. And what you have in China today is a country going through, an economy going through what Japan and South Korea and Taiwan have already gone through. The pollution isn't nearly as bad as it was in London, London fog, when Britain was having its industrial revolution. If they're successful, if they keep growing 7, 8, 9, 10% a year, they will get to where Japan is today. It's going to take a while. If they fail, then every family is going to be burning coal at home, and then the worst pollution outcome. So what we must... China is now very environmentally conscious. It's happened at about $2,000 per capita in China. In Taiwan, South Korea, it took $5,000 or $6,000 per capita. Implementing that concern is a multi-generation task. But we have to hope that they're successful. We have to hope that they keep growing fast. Growth is not the problem. Growth is the solution. Thank you very much.
We have run somewhat over our time, and so I'm going to have to call a close. I would urge several of you whose questions have not been posed to speak privately with Mr. Overholt at the end of this meeting, and I'll turn it back over to our chairman.
Our thanks to Professor Scalapino and William Overholt. Shall we give them a round of applause, please? Bill's book is available for sale outside, and I am sure Bill will be happy to sign his book for you. We also would like to thank our audience here today, as well as those listening to this recording. Thank you again to the Asia Society of Northern California and the Berkeley China Initiative. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.